Welcome to the Creative Careers in Medicine podcast with your hosts, Dr. Amandeep Hansra, Dr. Dana Pung, and myself, Dr. Elise Puff. Join us as we talk to inspiring clinicians who have redefined their careers.
Today, I'm joined by Associate Professor Magdalena Simonis. She's a general practitioner, a government health advisor, a board director, a primary care researcher, and a recognized leader in women's health communication and advocacy for climate health and the integration of technology in healthcare. She regularly writes on health topics for the general public and is a health columnist for The Australian.
Hi, Dr. Magdalena Simonis. Welcome to the Creative Careers in Medicine podcast.
Hi, Elise. Thank you for having me. Really looking forward to chatting with you today.
Now, I understand you do quite a number of things, so I'd like to hear your description of your current roles and how you describe yourself to people.
Well, obviously, I'm in my clinical setting here. So I'm a GP, first and foremost. So I see patients every day, and I really enjoy that. That's probably my primary pleasure and love professionally. I've got patients that I've been seeing for over 30 years. So for me, the only thing missing from my life in this room is a coffee machine because we do a lot of chatting. But I am also a researcher with the University of Melbourne Department of General Practice. You know, I do my fair share of teaching through the Department of General Practice with Safer Families and Family Violence. I've developed quite a few educational materials for general practice on a variety of issues and topics, a lot of women's health stuff mainly and family violence things. I'm a board director. I really enjoy that. And I've been really involved with RSCGP and AMA, continue to be very involved in both. Interested also very deeply and have been from the outset in technology and health and digital literacy in medical practitioners, specifically, you know, around primary care and how we deliver that. And a lot of advocacy work and writing policy and pushing for change.
Yeah, I was saying to you before we kicked off that there's too much to cover because it does sound like you've just done so much, but I can also see how it all fits in together. Did any of this feel planned? If you think back to when you first got into medical school, did you have any idea where you'd end up now?
None. I was in the hospital system like all of us are to begin with, and I was tossing up between ONG, obstetrics and gynae, because I did my deobst and loved that, or accident and emergency. And it wasn't until, you know, we had to do a mandatory general practice training unit, and I really enjoyed that. And it wasn't until I actually bought my little house, which I then worked as a locum in general practice on my holidays, because at that stage interest rates were really high. They were like 15.5%. Crazy. Yeah. And when I was filling in for other GPs, I found I really, really enjoyed it. I found the complexity of it, the continuity of it, working through these massive files, paper files, and making sense of them, planning with the patients, looking forward into their projecting to the future and what that picture today might look like if it wasn't addressed. So I then enrolled to do my college exams, my fellowship exams, and then did that. And so I held on to ONG for a while and accident and emergency for a while because I was alone, single, and had a lot of time on my hands. So interest rates high, debt, undecided. So I worked in the evenings as an ED fill-in for a couple of the accident and emergency centres, one weekend in three in obstetrics, covering for the registrars at one of the hospitals where I trained, and did general practice by day.
Oh, wow. That sounds, You sound like you were very busy, but I love that it was something completely unrelated to medicine that actually got you in GP to begin with.
GP, yeah, it won hands down for me. Through general practice, I sort of didn't do a lot of the stuff that I do now directly related to general practice. I did other advocacy work, but it wasn't directly health related. So I've obviously had a fire in my belly for change forever. And that's a driver. And also, I think, you know, you build your family too, and that takes a big chunk. And my husband travelled extensively, so it wasn't as if I could take off and leave the kids alone. I was the third with children in the family. So by that stage, no one wants to babysit. Fair enough, because they've done the work with the others. So I had to be pretty resourceful in that respect. The rest unfolded out of a desire to get more involved. Partly I was invited to get onto a couple of committees. And the other was I basically invited myself by asking if they needed any help. And invariably for not-for-profits, that's a yes for most of them. And that's where you do a lot of learning and also do a lot of that policy development and also have the satisfaction of working in teams and pushing on a particular point or issue to the point of an outcome, which, you know, you're either happy with. And if you're happy with it, then you get a confidence around doing those sorts of things.
Do you remember the first advocacy sort of stream that you followed? Was it something that you were involved in as a student, or was it once you'd started practicing?
It was actually the National Women's Health Strategy, believe it or not. Around 2009, I was invited to look into that and sort of review it. I remember spending hours at night going through this and making comments. So that was the first big document that I put in a heck of a lot anonymously through another party, but I put in a lot. And I was very happy to see a lot of the suggestions were either mirrored by others who were commenting on similar things or adopted. So that was very, very good. And then I was being Greek. I'm Greek origin, obviously, daughter of migrants. So I'm bilingual and very involved in our own community. It was through Connection, basically, who invited me to participate or become involved in an aged care not-for-profit group called, in those days, it was Australian Greek Welfare, but now it's called Pronia, P-R-O-N-I-A. And they're one of the large aged care providers for elderly Greek citizens who really need support in the home, but not at the nursing home level. And I was on that board for 7 or 8 years, really loved that. So I think with those sorts of involvements and arrangements, you can really give a lot. And I thoroughly enjoyed that.
And then I want to hear a bit about your research work that you've done as well, because I feel a lot of the hospital roles center a lot around research and a lot of people have to meet certain research requirements. It's not done, but it's not as common that people are doing as much research work in GP. Was that something you were doing throughout, or how did you get involved in that?
Good question. So I was of that generation that no one really talked to us about our other options. You just went through hospital and found your own way. So we didn't have a lot of these conversations that doctors are having these days. In fact, I don't remember anywhere along my life having had a mentor, someone tapping me on the shoulder saying, you know, I see you here, or let me help you here. That was just go sink or swim, get on with your life and find your own path. So I didn't know that I could have a research path. I thought that it was either or. And it was one of my colleagues, she was the resident under me, and we were friends from uni days. And she went into primary care research after internship and general practice training, and then became the head of the Department of General Practice at Melbourne Uni, and then rang me when I was in practice to say, oh, you know, Magda, I'm setting up this Victorian Medical General Practice Research Network. I'd like you to participate. I didn't quite understand what that meant. I said, oh, yeah, I mean, yeah, I'll do that. Anything she asked me to do, I would. So from my rooms, I said yes and attended the first meeting and learned more about what general practice research networks were about. This was 2009 or so, or around then, 2008, 2009. And then through that, got a glimpse of the research of general practice. And it wasn't until I was involved with seeing a couple of cases that I was concerned about that I launched into it myself and requested that I do some research and therefore skilled up, which was supported to do that by, you know, doing the modules and that, got on with it from there. So it's not the largest of what I do because I'm a clinician, but I use my research skills and where I feel that there's an area that I want to research. And then I also use those skill sets to develop a lot of the material that we work from and in terms of training and modules and things, you know.
I'm interested. I feel like your clinical work would help so much with all of that other stuff that you've talked about, especially developing modules and all of that for actual practice. How much of your time currently is clinical versus non-clinical, and how do you find the balance between the two?
Well, I think I'm a full-time GP. I'm here every day, so I see patients every day. I punctuate my day with my meetings, such as here with you, and my staff now, you know, the staff are very familiar with my behaviour. And they know that if Magda has a meeting at 3 to not book anyone from 2 onwards because she always runs late. And my patients all know I run late. So I'm very lucky now that I've been in practice for a while. My patients pretty much all know me. I'll see the occasional new one, but mostly I see my own. And I still do see, I do have an interest in walk-ins too. So I think you sort of miss out a lot if you don't, you know, in terms of what's going on out there. I think it's probably 50-50. That's where I am. So a lot of work happens at night. You've just got to time it, time things, manage your energy levels. And then there are times where you just fall a bit behind on submitting certain things or just say, I can't do this. I don't have time to do this. Yeah. So you just don't commit to another project.
Yeah. Well, I'm very impressed that you're full-time in GP and doing all of these other things as well. The other thing that I am particularly interested to hear about is you do a bit of writing. I want to hear how you got involved in that and what that process is like.
I've been writing for years now, and I think that I'm now a health columnist for The Australian, but I've been writing for many, many years. In fact, I was writing for Bauer Media. I think it was called, I can't remember, it no longer exists, but I thought it was fabulous. I had to write articles on health every 2 weeks. Tell you the truth, I don't even remember how that came about. I think it was someone was a patient of mine who worked for Bauer and said, I really like your style and we're looking for someone. And I started writing a regular two-weekly column on all sorts of things, like from protecting your hearing to continence, health tips for staying well through the stages of life for women and men, what to do when, you know, during flu season, how to keep yourself well. So that was an ongoing interest. And I did that in between everything else. And then I wrote a few articles for News GP. I always found that we needed translating things from research into sort of usable information for GPs is really useful, especially on more complex topics and themes. And I think with just that whole evolution of writing skills and trust that the media had, it just built. I also wrote a lot and continue to write for a Greek paper called Neos Cosmos, which is probably the most read newspaper here in Australia. And I write in English and that's also translated into Greek. And I'm technically their doctor in the house. So I basically have access to that platform too, which has been fabulous too, just to reach the Greek community and help them. So during COVID, I did a heck of a lot of that. And then I do a lot of interviews. So on SBS, Radio National, also on SBS, I'm interviewed in Greek. So I talk on health topics. So now I'm doing a two-weekly podcast in Greek on snippets on health, and that's evolved.
Yeah, wow. How did you find it initially when you started writing? That sounds like a different sort of writing to, say, writing a patient letter or even different writing the content for GPs versus writing for the general public. Did that come naturally to you or was there anything you did to upskill?
That's a really good point, Elise. And I have noticed that I can switch different styles according to the audience. So if I know who I'm talking to, I can adjust the way I use my language. And the writing style I use for the mainstream media is different to the writing style I would use, let's say, for News GP or for MJA Insight, yeah, for our colleagues. So they are very different. And the way I write for the public is the way I communicate in my rooms. So I simplify things. And so many times my patients have said to me, oh, gee, I wish I had my husband here so he could hear you say this because I can't sound like you. Or, you know, Magdalena, do you have a podcast? And I was asked this like years ago. I said, no, that's the kind of thing, just really simple information that people can understand with the key points.
Do you ever get patients that come and see you because they've found you through the media somewhere?
I get emailed quite a bit for advice, which is a bit tricky always, or for, you know, sometimes they're complimentary, but sometimes it's also for advice. And I think yes, but no. Yes, I do, but there's a limit to what I can achieve. It's too busy. So I have a restriction on who I see and how I can expand because I can't take on anymore.
Yeah, and I can see that you've woven that women's health interest that you had from the beginning throughout your career. Is that the case in your clinical work as well, that you see more women's health, or do you have particular niche areas that you see, or is it pretty general?
Mm-hmm. It's pretty general, actually. Yeah. And I see 50-50 women, men. The interest in women's health has been, obviously, I mean, obstetrics, gynae, that was, I was going to be an ONG. So there's always been that interest. As a woman, you attract female patients of all ages, but men also, I've found, feel pretty comfortable with female GPs. I've got an interest in both, in all areas. So I think that's the tricky thing. Do you narrow down and focus just on one area of medicine? In general practice, you can't. I can't do that. Probably musculoskeletal isn't my favourite. Put it this way. That's not my absolute forte, even though I've had my fair share of those injuries myself. There are certain things that I have more of an interest and more of a skill in also. But across the board, I think I'm a true generalist and I really enjoy that and I will maintain that. I still do minor procedures. I still do remove moles, I insert IUDs, all the stuff that a general practitioner does.
Yeah, wow.
I'm rather old school.
Yeah, you sound like a generalist inside and outside of your clinical work as well. The fact that you're task switching between meetings and actually having appointments as well is pretty impressive. I'm interested to hear if there's anything that you particularly want, any big goals that you have for the next couple of years, any particular areas in medicine that you feel like you haven't tapped into or you want to tap into more?
I think at this stage, it's where I'm at is I really enjoy my writing, the writing and the communication. And I think communication of health messaging is really important, especially in this day and age, and especially with what's to come. I'm concerned about the misinformation that's out there. So I will be constantly on the lookout for this and constantly trying to improve ways to communicate good health messaging and correct, accurate messaging in a way that doesn't confuse people. I think also in terms of technology and health, I think that this is the huge area I'm, you know, immensely committed to, making sure that we don't steer away from putting guardrails around that, but also innovating and assisting our health sector, because I think that with the impending aging population and chronic disease blowout, I think the system's going to just burst at the seams. So we have to do things much better. And that's everything from interoperability, communication, sharing of information, avoid replication and duplication and waste that's generated just because the systems are so disorganized in so many ways, like this mix of spaghetti, and we've all got to try and make all the systems at the back end are just not doing what we want them to do. So I think that this is one of those areas that I think that GPs should be really actively involved in. I am always keen to use the GP voice in tech spaces.
I'm interested, you said earlier when you started GP, it was all of the paper-based and sifting through all of that. And now it's obviously most practices are run online, at least to some degree, if not completely. Is there any other major changes that you've seen in your time in GP? I don't know, the length of appointments or people's expectations of a GP appointment, any major things that stand out?
I think certainly in my cohort of patients, they're more complex, they take longer time, they're older. And so very, very rarely will someone come in just for a single item visit. It's very rarely going to be, oh, I'm just here for a UTI. I think on average, there might be 4 or 5 at least items that need to be ticked off. And sometimes they're disparate. And it's because people have also time pressures. So this expectation, one problem, one consult, doesn't work. However hard you try, because when you think about your patients, you think about also their life and how busy they are and the pressures that they have. And also the cost of just taking time away from work or needing to come and pay for another consultation. So I think for me, it's also that I'm always juggling that to some extent. It's the complexity. It's just increased. It always was there, but I see it now more. And that's maybe also because my patients have been seeing me a long time and they're just older.
Yeah. And how do you think, say, in 10 years' time, GP will look different to how it looks right now?
I think that there will be an evolution of our specialty where we are true physicians in health. We have replaced a general physician, so I'm not sure about what your experience is at the moment in the hospital system, but in my hospital days, you had your surgical training and your medical training, and your medical training was delivered by a general physician. And that included cardiology and gastroenterology, and you did do renal medicine, but this was primarily done by the general physician, and we don't have general physicians anymore. Everyone's super specialised in non-GP specialist areas. So I see general practice as a specialty. I see myself as a physician, as a GP, but who is a physician? I'm expert at so many things, and I can go very deep and very broad. And I can also make sense of things that my non-GP specialist colleagues don't have the skills in. So they often refer back to the GP or to me specifically to have that oversight. And I think we're going to have a group, we're going to evolve into GP specialists that are the true physicians.
Interesting. And are you working in a metropolitan setting?
I'm CBD based, have been. I'm a city based person and I love it. Take me to the burbs and I feel like I wither. And it's just, I love the hustle and bustle of a city. But I see people from all around. So a lot of my patients that have moved, they've done the tree change, sea change, still continue to come in. So they'll catch a train in. They might work from their remote place, in which case we'll do some telehealth occasionally, but mostly they'll drive in or catch the train in. So it's diverse. And some have moved interstate but still continue to come. Being city-based has been great that way because you're accessible. Public transport, you know.
It's interesting. I ask that because the role you described sounds like what I picture of rural generalist type pathway, which is crazy to think that you're doing that same sort of work in a metro setting. I just, not having worked in GP, I wouldn't have pictured that. So that's really interesting.
And I do. I've resuscitated people that walk in off the street, you know, so it's pretty full on and no day is predictable. No matter what I see on my list, it's never going to be like that. But I love that.
Now, my penultimate question, I want to ask if there's any advice that you would give if you could talk to your younger self, say just having graduated medical school or that sort of age.
I would say talk to your colleagues who are in training and talk also to consultants about their experience and what they found took them. I also think it's important for us to not lose contact with our non-medical self. So one of the difficulties that we all face is that our training is so intense, our student days are so intense, and then our work life becomes so intense and absorbs us that we're always thinking of medicine and around other medical people. So I think keep non-medical people in your life. That's really important. You know, your artist friends and your musician friends, keep them in your life. Don't lose contact with them. They're your sanity. They're your break away from everything. So I'd say 80% of who I socialize with outside of my work is non-medical. And that for me is very satisfying because I never talk work when I'm socializing. And half of them don't know what I do. So I think that it's really important to keep your contacts that are non-medical through your life and also to learn from the people that you're training with about their career paths and what their experience of it is.
I love that advice. That's excellent. And our final question we ask everyone that comes on the podcast, if you could picture another universe where you're not a doctor and you did something different to what you currently do, what is your dream career? You don't have to worry about money or any sort of actual skill that you might need to have this job, but what would your dream alternate reality career be?
You'll laugh at this. A classical pianist.
Oh, I love that. Do you play piano?
Very badly. But when I fantasize, I fantasize. When I listen to the music that I love, I fantasize that I'm playing it and it just makes me very happy.
Oh, that's beautiful.
I've even got the dress and the piano and the stage and just the immersion. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing everything about your career. I'm sure that wasn't everything, but a lot of great insights. Thank you.
Thanks, Elise. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Creative Careers in Medicine podcast, a proud member of the Talking Health Tech podcast network. We hope that we'll see you at our upcoming conference, which is taking place Saturday, August 23rd and Sunday, August 24th in Melbourne. We will be bringing together inspiring speakers from all walks of medicine and an equally inspiring audience that we'd love to have you as a part of. Follow us on socials and subscribe to our newsletter so you don't miss any announcements. The Creative Careers in Medicine podcast acknowledges the traditional owners of country throughout Australia and recognises the continuing connection to lands, water and community. We pay our respects to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures and elders past, present and emerging.